Okay, I am back once again. I've been busy, actually. I was going to put up a podcast last week, but I had court this week. And so when I have court, I don't know how other pathologists do it, but I tend to over-prepare for court because I prepare for absolutely every single question that could be dreamed up or imagined, and therefore it takes a lot of time. So as a result, I didn't get a podcast out last week, so I'm going to catch up this week. If you are listening for the first time, I am Dr. Wolf. I am a forensic pathologist, also known as medical examiner. And today we're going to talk about O.J. Simpson, but I'm not going to do like a forensic deep dive on the case, on the actual murders, or really, I'm not going to get too involved with the forensics of his trial, because, you know, these are things that could take multiple episodes that are, you know, an hour long just to cover all that forensic evidence. I'm mainly addressing the point of, was his brain examined? What would it mean for him to have his brain examined? And also kind of like tangentially talking about who do we autopsy when we autopsy? Because not everybody gets an autopsy. And I've talked about this before, but it's always good to have a refresher. So O.J. Simpson, former football player and probably at this point known most for the trial in the 1990s, a double murder trial in which he was acquitted. And if you weren't alive at that time, it's kind of hard to put into words just how all-encompassing that trial was. I mean, it was all that you heard about on the news all the time, every news station. I was actually in college at that time, and it was pretty crazy. It was all anyone talked about. Now, in today's world, where the biggest news story you've ever heard will come in and it'll be out of the news in like 4 days. So I don't know. I don't know today if it would have had as much of a pull as it did back then. But long story short, if in case you're not caught up with what happened back then, I mean, most people are, but I have listeners around the world who maybe don't know exactly what happened. O.J. Simpson was a very famous and very good football player in the National Football League, mostly in the 1970s. And he kind of got into acting, and he just made, like, you know, TV appearances, and he was kind of just seen as this, like, goofy, you know, happy, you know, easygoing guy. Well, then, in exactly the date, I don't know, but it was in the early 90s, he was involved. His wife, which is Nicole Brown Simpson, was murdered, and then a person that his wife knew named Ron Goldman was murdered. And it was quite brutal. A lot of like slashing, stabbing, sharp force injury type attack. He became the primary suspect early, and he was charged, and they went through this whole big trial. And then of course he was found not guilty. Now there's a couple of reasons why he was found not guilty, and I will perhaps cover that just minimally. But the big thing that happened is he died of prostate cancer just in the last week. And whenever a celebrity dies, I usually get a lot of messages, direct messages and comments. Even if I'm not talking about it, they come to me and they ask questions. And so I had several direct messages that said, well, early reports suggest that O.J. Simpson had CTE, also known as chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And I didn't quite buy this, you know, because the rumor mill on the internet is you really can't believe almost everything that comes up every day. You have to take a moment to verify information. And I'll tell you why this information did not seem credible to me. Number one, he's 76 years old. We don't often autopsy people in their mid-70s unless there is a tragic, sudden death, a criminal-involved death. So, for instance, a murder, we would autopsy a 76-year-old. If there was a criminal in element that didn't involve murder, let's say there was a car accident or a trucking company hits a car, passenger is 76 and dies. Well, we'll still autopsy because that case might go to trial someday. So, first of all, when hearing that he was 76, I said, that doesn't seem right. Number two, he had a chronic and terminal illness. So we don't often autopsy people with chronic and terminal illnesses unless the family requests it. In this case, he had prostate cancer. Presumably that was metastatic and was in stage. I think he was on hospice. So number two, I hear that and I go, I don't think he would have been autopsied. This is a 76-year-old man with a chronic and terminal illness. However, there was a chance that maybe the family ordered that and wanted to know more about the cancer or wanted to have more studies on his brain. But number three is all these people that direct messaged me and said, there's, you know, evidence of CTE. Let me tell you something. When a brain is sent for CTE exam, it takes a long time to get the results. You don't open up the head and go, aha, CTE, clearly. No, it's a process. And let me tell you about this process, because I have been asked to remove the brains of former NFL players and former athletes that involve a lot of trauma to the head. So football players and also soccer players, I have had to do those before. And it's a process. I mean, taking the brain out is not particularly difficult. But once you get the brain out, there's a couple of different ways you can deal with it. One is that you slice the brain directly down the middle, like a sagittal section, and you will put one half in ice fresh, and you'll put one half in formalin or formaldehyde to fix the brain. And then that brain is shipped overnight to a special lab that studies brains. And there aren't very many in the country, but you know, there's Mayo Clinic and there's Cleveland Clinic and there's the various, I'm on the East Coast and I forget the name, but I think it's affiliated with Harvard. I've sent a few brains out there. It's not something that's quickly done. I mean, you have to get the brain out relatively soon because it needs to be fresh, and so they can run whatever, testing that needs to be done on that brain, on the fresh brain, and on the formalin fixed part, okay? So once that brain is received, it's processed by the lab. There are many tests ordered. There's the gross examination. There's the microscopic examination. There might be immunohistochemical examination. And there may be other special studies, special stains, genetic testing. And all of this takes a long time. When I send a very basic brain, let's just say for Alzheimer's, family asks me, please do this brain. We want to know if this is a genetic form of Alzheimer's, etc. I think the earliest I've ever got one back is maybe 6 weeks after I sent it. So when you hear people say stuff like, OJ's brain showing signs of CTE, you can pretty much immediately discount it because there simply isn't enough time to perform that study. So that was a red flag for me. However, I did wonder if perhaps what happened, and I'm just kind of devil's advocate on myself right now, if you have a brain exam and you are looking for a prior injury, you can see that sometimes if the injury is severe enough. Like, I have had people who have played contact sports, but also people who've just been in like motorcycle or car accidents 10 years prior, and they have behavioral changes, and the family reports this, and then I open the skull, I can see big areas of where there was bleeding, like a chronic, a traumatic, like a subdural hematoma type area. They're kind of a yellowish brown appearing, thickening really of the surface of the brain. In fact, I think I posted it recently on one of my socials. It might be my Substack. I guess I have a Substack called Dr. Darren Wolf. And so we go over pathology stuff there. I show images that are a little more in depth. You can go there and subscribe if you want. I also show stuff at Instagram, although they don't let me show as much. However, and rarely TikTok as well. But however, the point I'm making is that if a person sees these big injuries immediately after opening the skull, then you might be able to say, gosh, maybe this person does have CTE in a preliminary brain autopsy report. It would be like signs of chronic injury or something like that. And so I said, well, maybe that's what happened. But he did not have his brain examined. And I know this. They actually had an article last week. There are actually multiple sources for this article. I mean, I you know, big news publications, I think USA Today and New York Times. But long story short, OJ himself actually thought he might have CTE. And people close to him said that he was very forgetful. He personally said he thinks he's got CTE. He would talk to himself. He didn't seem himself, okay? And it's not really that hard to believe when you consider the era that he played football in, okay? He played football in an era when the football helmets were nowhere near the technology that we have now. And as a running back, I believe he was a running back, you know, that's the football player that's going to get hit the hardest most often during the game. All players get hit. Quarterbacks get sacked. You know, wide receivers get hit. But the running back probably gets the bulk of the plays, and they're getting slammed. So, you know, for him to have CTE would not be surprising, especially given, like I said, the era. He may have had multiple concussions, too many to count, really. And long story short, you've got a situation here now, and what we're getting at is that did OJ commit a violent crime? He was acquitted of that violent crime, but many people believe that OJ did that. That is a very violent, and let's just say he did. You know, OJ was found not guilty. I'm not saying he did it, but I'm saying, I think a lot of people are saying, if he did, could CTE explain this violent behavior? Because it is something that we see with CTE. Not only violence against other people, but violence against oneself. You know, many individuals who are diagnosed with CTE have, you know, they've committed suicide, and their brain gets sent and they find this evidence of CTE. So I think people were really interested in what his brain showed because they wanted to have an explanation for, is this why he was a violent person? Now, you know, it's contrary. And I think the reason why people are so surprised is it's contrary to his persona. What people knew about him, they said he was just sort of a easygoing, fun-loving, funny guy. And then he may have, you know, done these violent things. So the article that came out said that the family, you know, was actually directly asked, do you want an examination of the brain? And the quote is, the family gave a hard no from requests from scientists to study the brain. Now, I don't know what scientists reached out. I know as a private practice pathologist, I would have no interest in reaching out to a family of a recently deceased, but I would imagine that perhaps experts were saying, hey, maybe we can give you some closure on some of the problems he was having, because he was, in the last couple of decades of his life, apparently he was having a lot of kind of neuropsychiatric type stuff. And I'm sorry, I'm scrolling through the article right now. And just to review, CTE, I've talked about it a little bit on here. I talk about it on some of my other socials, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, meaning a pathologic condition of the brain resulting from many concussive hits to the brain, which can result in mood swings, impulse control, depression, and aggression. So I think people were looking you know, for this, for their family to say, yes, we're going to do it. But ultimately, the family said, no, we do not want this this exam. So, you know, you can't, I mean, they have control over it. And if he didn't have it in his will to say, yes, I absolutely want my brain examined, really nothing's going to happen. So if you see videos of people saying that OJ had CTE, and if you see, you hear people talking about OJ had CTE, it's possible that OJ had CTE, but we can't prove that he had CTE. There is no proof other than some of the clinical stuff in terms of memory loss, mood swings, possible history of aggression. And even then, you can't diagnose CTE clinically. Technically, you could do MRI scans and get maybe some indication of prior injury, but the only true way to make a definitive diagnosis of CTE is with a brain autopsy, which he did not have. And so, you know, basically what you see, and I'm not going to do an entire lecture on CTE. I am not a brain pathologist. And personally, that's not something that I diagnose. Just so you know, forensic pathologists very often do have neuropathologic training. I personally don't, because I did an anatomical and pathology, clinical pathology residency program and decided I wanted to work. I did not do an immediate fellowship after work. And I worked as a surgical pathologist. And then when I decided to do a fellowship, I chose forensics. So to become a neuropathologist, a brain pathologist, I would have had to do an additional fellowship. And so I don't personally make that diagnosis. I send it to a brain pathologist who specializes in that disease. And there aren't a ton of them around the country. And then there's even people within the neuropathology community, which are somewhat contrarian about the concept of CTE. I know there's at least one neuropathologist who says it's not a real thing and that we're imagining it. Not being a neuropathologist, I don't really want to wade into that, but I personally, just as a person who looks at a lot of brains and sees a lot of chronic injury and people who've had accidents or played football and stuff like that, I mean, I absolutely do believe it's a real thing, but academically, it's not something that I can go too much into without stepping out of my bounds, which I don't think that's a good idea for me to do. I don't think it's a good idea for anyone to do. But, you know, like I said, this case with OJ, there's so much to talk about. There's personally, medically, what he may have been experiencing. And then you go back to the forensics of that case. And there's just a couple of things I want to say about the actual outcome of that case, because I don't think a lot of people understand it who weren't closely watching it, or people who maybe were born after the fact and kind of look tangentially at the evidence and say, well, how in the world did he get acquitted? There's a couple of things I want to point out that I thought was huge on this acquittal. Number one was the glove. Okay, so there's the famous bloody glove that was found at the scene. And apparently they matched it to, a glove that he used to wear a lot of. They even had footage of him announcing football games wearing the same glove and stuff like that. And that's not to say that, yes, that's definitive evidence that he did it. But the glove was found at the scene hours later, blood-soaked, collected in an evidence bag, and it sat in an evidence bag for many months, obviously before the trial begins. And apparently the prosecution agreed to have him try on the glove at trial, and it really didn't fit. And it was right on camera. And so the famous quote from one of the defense attorneys, Johnny Cochran, was, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. Okay, that's probably the most famous line from that trial. Well, the problem I have with that, and I do really think the prosecution, if they okayed that, they really, really messed up. Because when you have something like leather, and it's soaked in a thick liquid like blood, it's going to shrivel and shrink up a little bit over time, and it's going to become even more leathery. It's not going to be like soft leather anymore. It's going to be extremely hard and kind of crunchy. And anybody who tries to put that glove on, it's not, if it's the hand is about the same size, it's definitely going to look like it doesn't fit. So that was kind of an insane decision by them, because that was just an easy slam dunk to show the jury. And I think that caused the jury to have a lot of doubts and say, well, I don't really know. Maybe he wasn't wearing that glove and it was some other assailant. So that was another one. But I think the other big issue was that, and this is what I know about the blood portion of the case, is that apparently, you know, he had blood all over the inside of his vehicle. He had blood in his house, but there was one sock that was found with blood. I guess it was at his house, and there was blood on the sock. But the blood they believe may have been placed there by someone in the police department. And I believe the explanation at the time was that they tested the blood spot, and they found that it contained the chemical EDTA. And EDTA is kind of an anti-chelation agent that, and anybody who listens to this that does any kind of medicine or draws blood, phlebotomist, that kind of thing, you know that there's EDTA-containing tubes. Well, EDTA does not occur in the body. It only occurs in a tube form. So the logic was that if there's blood on the sock that contains EDTA, it must have been planted from a tube. And I think that during the trial, they asked one of the police if they planted evidence, and instead of saying no, he said, "I plead the fifth." And so what that did was it created reasonable doubt for pretty much all the other blood evidence in the case, and then the glove evidence was also pretty much canceled out. So what the defense did is they were able to have the jury kind of mentally delete a lot of the important information from the case, you know, circumstantial type stuff, like where was he, his timing and stuff like that. And then they got the stuff thrown out, basically, that was really important. The blood evidence, the glove evidence, they got it thrown out. And not necessarily on technicality either. They just did a really good job assessing whether or not this evidence could have been planted. And the thing is, there's always going to be that question, well, if he truly did it, why would anybody plant more evidence? And that question we'll never really know. And I think that also speaks to why the jury did acquit him, because they said, well, if there's blood on this sock, then why would there, you know, could the blood inside of his Bronco also be planted? And so, I mean, I guess if I put myself in that situation, it would have been hard to not acquit based on that, because and back on the sock, I think the idea was, if he didn't injure his foot and he was wearing a shoe, how did blood get on his sock? That kind of thing. So the logic from the defense was the police framed him, and therefore you can't prove that he did it. So it was probably one of the most shocking outcomes, because if you sat and watched the daily kind of like back and forth of the trial, I mean, it did feel an awful lot like he was right there when it happened, and that he very likely did it. I mean, I think he may have even had some motive. But ultimately, when it comes down to trial, you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and they actually had reasonable doubt. And I love I should talk about trials more than I do, but I love the medical portion so much, I don't really talk about trials. I was in trial this week, and someday I will talk about that as well, because it was a trial that was in national news a couple years ago. I shouldn't say a trial, a case that was in the national news, and then the trial actually occurred this week. The problem is, I actually enjoy testifying. I think it's pretty fun. It's like teaching. You have to teach the jury. However, it eats up so much of my time that I dislike it, because for every trial, I prepare for hours, literally hours, and that doesn't include pre-trial meetings. That doesn't include travel. That doesn't include the time I spend in the courthouse. Like this week, I was in the courthouse for 4.5 hours. And so it's one of the most irritating parts of my job, but it's also kind of fun. But at some point, maybe I'll start talking a little more about the legal stuff. I even thought I might do some lectures for people who are interested, who might be going into this field or who may be in a legal field, because there are a lot of practical things about testifying that people need to know. It's pretty fun to be on that side. I even thought for a second I might try to go get a law degree. But I'm like, you know, I'm almost 5 decades old at this point. I think I've kind of proved myself. I'll just, you know, focus on art or something. But anyways, I think I've said what I need to say here. The bottom line is that O.J. Simpson did not have his brain examined, and if anybody says he does, they're simply, they've been misinformed. So I guess I should at this point go ahead and remind everyone that I have a Substack. Again, Dr. Darren Wolf, we look at cases. There's free posts there, but there's also paid posts. And my logic is the paid posts are the more, for lack of a better term, gory, involved internal examination type stuff, or stuff that involves a lot of teaching that basically you kind of need to go to med school or go to a pathology residency to get. Otherwise, it's difficult to find it. I also have paid Substack because I kind of look at it as maybe subsidizing the time I use to create podcasts. Because like I said, this podcast doesn't earn any money. So if you want to subscribe to my Substack, you also get to learn stuff and you're supporting the podcast. I've got a TikTok called The Dead Letter. Haven't been posting much over there very much lately. However, I have hundreds of videos that have all sorts of good stuff on it. Instagram is also called The Dead Letter. I post pretty much, I don't post there a ton. I post my story every day and I post pictures when they let me because, like I said, they don't like gory stuff there. I do have a YouTube channel called Knife After Death. If you haven't checked it out, I have not posted new videos there. I used to do lives there, but I really haven't had time to do lives lately. People have been trying to get me to do some long form content, like lectures. I'm looking into the proper format and how I might want to conduct those lectures because, like I've said many times, I have people who have zero science education who are just interested. And then I also have people who are MDs. I have people who are forensic pathologists who listen to me. So I have to conduct my lectures in a way that's not too far above people who don't have any science education and not too far below people who are in my field. So it's kind of like walking a tightrope. If you have any questions or comments, you can, of course, find me on any of the socials and give me a message. And otherwise, thanks for listening. And, we'll see you next time.